Postcards from Beyond, written and narrated by Paul Harris. Solitude. Traditional accounts have it that, after many hundreds of thousands of lifetimes preparing to fulfill his role as an historical Buddha, the Bodhisatta, the Buddha to be, took up his final living form as Prince Siddhartha Gautama. It's said that during his long round of rebirths, he developed boundless compassion for beings and a comprehensive understanding of how conventional existence works. In his last life, he dedicated himself to realizing the transcendental or supramundane wisdom of Nibbana. Upon his enlightenment, he was, as a result, blessed with a complete knowledge of life, both how to live most effectively in the world and how, ultimately, to transcend it altogether. The culmination of his endeavours, the Four Noble Truths and the Noble Eightfold Path, balances the natural human instinct for social integration with the need for solitude and deeper investigation into life. Some people mistakenly believe that working towards their own enlightenment is somehow selfish. They think that the ideal of Buddhism should be to dedicate oneself entirely to helping relieve the suffering of others without regard for oneself. This, however, is not what the Buddha taught. There are undoubtedly times when seeking solitude and detachment from the wider world would be inappropriate, when war is on one's doorstep, for instance. Other than in such extreme cases, however, it's perfectly permissible for people to seek solitude to deepen their understanding of life. After his countless lifetimes of developing wisdom, the Buddha understood that suffering can never be eradicated through external action alone. Realizing that the true cause of suffering was an internal matter, that of craving, he maintained that mindfulness was the one way to understanding. He therefore instructed his monks to find solitude in nature, to be in the wildernesses and seek out empty places where they could practice without being disturbed. Although living in a forest as a penniless mendicant recluse isn't really possible in our culture and climate, there are still plenty of ways to find solitude. If it's the case that someone has not yet committed to marriage, family and career, and if they are free of debt, are in good health, and are not wanted by the police, then training as a full-time recluse in a Buddhist monastery provides the best possible conditions for practice. For those whose circumstances don't allow that level of involvement, solitude can still be found through attending regular week-long silent retreats, where such conditions are replicated. Solitude can, however, be found by anyone on a daily basis. For, whenever we sit down with eyes closed to meditate, that itself is the practice of solitude. Before I entered into full-time training, wherever I went to work, I always managed to find a nearby park to sit and have my lunch, and this gave me at least a little time and space for mindfulness and quiet reflection. One can only really be comfortable and happy in solitude, however, if your relationship with the rest of life is harmonious. This requires of meditators to live an ethical life, which means paying attention to their outward behaviour and ensuring that it's as harmless as possible. Keeping the precepts, therefore, engaging in parami, compassionate activities, especially developing metta, friendliness to all beings, are integral aspects of the Noble Eightfold Path and essential to the meditator's overall aim of realizing freedom from suffering. You cannot transcend a world that you are still at odds with. In recent years, the phrase engaged Buddhism has been coined as a way to stress the importance of driving forward social change. This, however, is an unnecessary adjunct, as the Buddha's teaching is already entirely engaged. Seeking solitude is not at all the same thing as hiding away and being indifferent to the suffering around us. Living an ethical life is undertaken on an ongoing basis in concurrence with meditation. Solitude is not isolation. In reality, you cannot divorce yourself from the rest of the world, no matter how hard you try. Sitting alone in a mountain cave, without access even to a mobile signal, you are still utterly connected to your world. After all, let's not forget that Nibbana is the realization that reality is and has always been non-dual and empty of any division. So many people seem to be wary of solitude and choose to cram their lives full of useful or interesting things to do, or constantly seek out entertainment and distraction. Even a day out rambling in the countryside can so easily become a chatterbox's jamboree. There seems to be such an investment in constant conversation, in expressing oneself and airing one's precious views and opinions. It's as if to simply sit or walk without continuous verbal babbling is somehow a failing. And how uncomfortable people feel during one of those awkward silences when, for once, no one can think of anything to say. Yet, in reality, how much of what is spoken is even vaguely important? Would the world actually end if, perhaps, what you felt in such urgent need of expressing was actually left unsaid? Furthermore, what peculiar force is it that propels such constant verbal diarrhea? The answer, conversely, is the same reason why those who are committed to realizing enlightenment actively seek solitude, that of ignorance and craving. Whenever we become truly quiet, we start to become aware of life as it really is, and this can often feel very uncomfortable. Unschooled in the workings of our subjective experience, we distrust or even fear our own company. There is little or no understanding of how our minds operate, and even less understanding of the inherent emptiness at the heart of life. It's no wonder, therefore, that fear emerges, prompting us to create the white noise of constant chatter and diversion as a way of ignoring reality. The meditator seeks out solitude not out of hatred for life, but to discover it. He or she forsakes the worldly ways of chatter, entertainment, and distraction precisely to experience that awkward, uncomfortable silence. Through experiencing it, they come to understand it for what it really is and overcome any fear of it. As well as the external chatter, the internal mental chatter of constant narration, judgment, and comparison is also sacrificed. The meditator learns how to pluck the world out of the mind and comes to understand that the quiet mind is not an enemy. Such inner solitude is delightful. The quiet mind is at peace with its surroundings and at peace with itself. It's the window through which deep insights into the nature of life are received and comprehended. Solitude is not loneliness. Loneliness is a form of suffering born of comparison and wanting life to be different than it is. Much of a person's sense of alienation can be removed by undertaking the Buddha's mundane training. Ultimately, through learning to calm and quieten the mind, you come to realize that you are never alone, because in reality, there is no separation anywhere at all. The quiet mind is quiet precisely because there is no self-concern. States of mind such as loneliness or a sense of abandonment are devilish tactics the ego conjures up to ensure that the delusion of selfhood is maintained at all costs. So much of our mental chatter is simply there to reinforce the self-enclosing wall of ignorance. It's only the quiet mind, the mind that enjoys this inner solitude, that can see what lies beyond that wall. You wake up at dawn, unzip the tent, and take in the view. What a beautiful morning. You look down into the valley where the sun is just beginning to bathe the rolling hills in its gentle morning light. A delicate white mist hangs above the river below, giving the scene an air of mystery. Everything is so still and peaceful. There is no breeze. It all looks so enchanting, and as no one else is around yet, you decide to go for a walk down to the river. You quietly descend through a field of tall golden grasses and colourful wild flowers, marvelling at their fragile beauty. For a little while, you follow a deep ancient track and carefully pick your way over the huge gnarled roots of the old trees that line the route. Still nothing stirs, until you hear a rustling in the undergrowth, and, turning quickly, catch a brief glimpse of what you fancy might be a badger. The rustling stops instantly, and wary of frightening the creature, whatever it may be, after a brief pause, you carry on your way. A tiny village nestles at the river's edge, and you stand on a stone bridge, watching as plumes of mist rise from the surface of the water, coalesce, and drift quietly a few meters above the river. Although there's a strong current below, the river's surface appears still and perfectly mirrors the white mist, the blue sky beyond, and the green of the trees and vegetation on the riverbank. Someone in the village must have a dovecot, because 9 pure white doves are circling in wide arcs around you in perfect, silent harmony. These pictures, these fragile pictures, come together in one moment of perfect, silent harmony and are gone. And that is all there is. There is no solidity, no real substance. It's all a mirage, empty of any intrinsic, separate existence. It's so delightful to understand emptiness, the emptiness of form. It's magical, mysterious, and you cannot capture it. Understanding emptiness is total immersion in life. There is no you separate from the picture. There is just the coming together and dissolution of the picture, and this is timeless perfection. To realize emptiness is to know what love really is.